Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller here. We're looking at growing vegetables and fruit on the program today. And with us, once again, Kevin Chesso. He is the UW Extension Area Agriculture Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. As part of his job, he oversees the Spooner Research Station, and he'll tell us about his work there and also what becomes of all the food they produce. And, of course, we'll take your comments and questions as we move along. Are you having problems with your veggies or your fruit trees or plants this year? Questions about how to establish healthy soil? Join in. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Kevin Chesso, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. As always, a pleasure. It's been a little while, and so glad to be back on.
Yeah, it has been a while. And you've been, speaking of a while, you've been working at the Spooner Research Station for a while, quite a while now. Tell us about your work there.
Sure. Actually, I started here in my position with UW Extension, and I'm still employed by UW-Madison Division of Extension. And I started my partnership here at the Spooner Ag Research Station in January of 1999. So this is my 25th season of getting to partner with UW-Madison CALS. So the College of Ag and Life Sciences are the overseeing college, I guess, that manages the research station. So just to correct what you had said earlier, I'm not necessarily the person in charge. That would fall on my colleague, Phil Holman. And Phil is the research station superintendent, you know, overall manager of the property, all the things that have to happen to keep this place operating. And he also oversees the research projects that are on the station. So he's kind of the overall property manager. And then I partner with the research station to do my work and the extension outreach that accompanies with that. So I'm very unique in that my office is located right here at the Spooner Ag Research Station, just east of downtown Spooner, if you will. And the station has been here since 1909. And like all the research stations that are across the state, we have varied focused projects and missions, but it's to support research from primarily UW-Madison faculty, staff, and other university partners. But on occasion, we will moonlight and do other projects for a local business, private companies, that kind of stuff. So I've had the really unique opportunity to be involved personally with research in partnership with Cal. So the vegetable side is where I like to pay attention, right?
For the most part. Tom in Madison has a question for you already. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Larry. Earlier this summer, when they began doing closeouts at the nursery, I purchased two small boxwoods, two small barberries, and two small butterfly bushes that, unfortunately, I didn't put in the ground yet. I'm wondering, should I still put them in the ground, or should I bring them in the house and let them overwinter and kind of nurture them inside? I just don't want them to die on the deck or in the garage for lack of having been planted.
And sure. You're in, yep. And Tom's in Madison, so southern.
Okay. Yeah. Well, anytime we have a living, plant, it's got those basic needs. We obviously have to make sure it maintains, water, light, nutrients. And if it's been living in a pot, I can almost guarantee you that it's going to be root bound. And root-bound plants always have a disadvantage in the fact that they're stuck into this container and roots start going round and round, and we get this concept called root girdling, which really can be problematic if we don't get that plant out of the pot into either a larger container or find a permanent place to plant it or even a temporary place. So anytime we can get those plants out of the pot into a larger area where their roots can, you know, maybe explore and grow out, and, you know, it's just much more healthy and less stressful. So, you know, I'm assuming the plants are still looking somewhat healthy. And now you have to decide, how do I keep them alive until you find a permanent spot? If you have that permanent spot, I would go ahead and get them in the ground right now. No sense waiting. But certainly you want to knock that pot, you know, that plant out of the pot. And if you got to take a pruners and cut through some of those roots and pry them apart and get some of those circling roots removed, because they have like a tendency to be fixed in that circular pattern with the pot, and they'll continue to kind of grow in a circle and not necessarily explore surrounding soil. So you really got to not be shy in disturbing some of that root ball. And then just do all the right proper planting techniques, you know, make sure the roots have a place to go, and water and mulch, and keep them hydrated right up until the fall frost. Hopefully, you know, they establish and, you know, you have success in, you know, in the coming years, because they're all perennials, and just have to cross your fingers that, you know, they're going to be happy. But
frost, actually frost, probably up till ground freezes would be in terms of watering.
Yes. Plant roots, you know, perennials, they'll survive down into the 20s as far as soil temperatures go. So even though the top layer might be frozen because it's 32 and the ground is, you know, hard, the subsoil will always be a few degrees warmer. And if you got mulch, then the soil temperature can be maintained at maybe even 26 or 28 all winter long. And those plant roots are perennials, right? So they're going to be alive, and we need to take that into consideration and water and hydrate right up until the ground is frozen is kind of our recommendation.
Yep, absolutely. Tom, good luck. Get your shovel out and get started right after the show's over, of course. thanks for calling. Charles in Fall Creek, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Charles.
Morning, Larry. I was wondering if you guys could talk on a related subject. I rent, so I have a lot of my plants in pots, and I've tried to have different vegetables, but there's a lot of them that don't work out very well in pots. And I was hoping your guests could talk about what kind of fruits and vegetables are best suited for pots. I've had good luck with peppers. And then, you know, related to the last caller, how do you know when those plants are ready for a bigger pot?
Sure. Well, it always starts with understanding the plant and what it wants to be, if you will, when it grows up. You know, what's that mature plant size? And, you know, vegetables, most of them are annuals, and they'll complete their life cycle, you know, by this time of year. But if it's a vining type plant, like, you know, a tomato that wants to keep growing and flowering, and, you know, that can get 3-4 feet tall and spread another 2 feet. So the ultimate decision on what pot to use and how much soil that plant will need to have a healthy life depends on that individual plant's, you know, size. So container gardening is something I've been doing for many, many years on my back deck. I do it for a bunch of reasons. Deer browse, rabbit browse. I bring all that produce right outside my back sliding door and have it on my deck. Now, that doesn't prevent squirrels and chipmunks. They love those pots, and they'll dig in them and bury nuts and cause problems. But for the most part, it's in an area where I don't have to worry about the deer browse. And the downside is you got to water every day, sometimes twice a day when it's hot. So container gardening is definitely something I encourage people to try. Containers have to have holes in the bottom. The potting soil needs not to be, don't use native soil. Mix it with sphagnum moss, compost. Buy a potting mix that's very porous with perlite and vermiculite, you know, because the compaction will happen from all the watering and the settling of the soil. So as far as, you know, when to transplant, again, if you start with a large enough pot in the spring for annual vegetables, you should be fine. Now, if you're talking a perennial plant, that can get a little tricky because now that pot is going to be exposed to the winter. And if we have sub-zero temperatures, we don't have the insulation around that pot if it's sitting above ground. So we need to either heal that pot in or mulch way around it. So I don't do any container gardening with perennials. All of mine are annuals. And I, you know, once they're done, I knock the soil out, compost the plant material, and save my potting soil and then regenerate it in the following spring. So I kind of recycle my potting soil and amend it, add, you know, more sphagnum moss or compost and make sure it's got the nutrients it needs. So container gardening is certainly something more people should try. And you can grow a little bit of food or a lot of food in containers right outside your door. So
what food do you grow in containers then? What vegetables? Charles is, you know, has luck with some and not others.
Yeah, peppers and tomatoes are fail safes. Again, knowing, you know, how big that tomato is going to get. There's bush varieties of tomatoes and ones that are made specifically for containers. And UW Extension has a publication specific to container garden plants and certain varieties that work well in containers. So peppers and tomatoes, again, you're going to need at least 5 gallons, if not larger container. Whatever that is, you can recycle stuff, make sure it's got the drainage hole. But I love to do lettuce and kale and mustard plants. The garden greens work wonderful in containers. You got a little dappled shade maybe from being on the back deck where there's not full sun all the time. But I eat salad literally every day from mid-May up until, you know, the final killing frost in October. So those leafy vegetables work really well in containers. But again, water is important, and you got to be around to do that. So those are my mainstays. Herbs, you know, those you can bring inside, you know, a lot of those herbs and even some of the leafy greens. You know, you might get them in a south-facing window in October and November and keep that going for a couple months. But I really like the stuff that I'm going to eat and enjoy, and I like to cook. You know, peas and radishes and carrots, those are things that I'd rather do in ground. So just start with the plants you like to eat and see how they do in containers and learn as you go.
Yeah, and Charles said he had good luck with the peppers. He certainly would have, I would think, have good luck with tomatoes, and especially zeroing in on those that are specifically bred for being in pots.
Right. Yep.
There you go, Charles. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. What about you? Questions? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in for Garden Talk. Just to let you know, in the last half hour of the show today, we'll talk about the Savannah Institute. It's having its upcoming perennial farm gathering, and we'll talk about the Institute and that gathering. It's an organization that helps promote agroforestry. It's a really interesting concept, and I know you're going to enjoy that. Right now, though, we're talking with Kevin Chesso, UW Extension Area Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Great to have him with us. And questions, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. And an email, why is it important to have a research station in the northern part of the state, and what zone are you in there?
Yes, well, of course, I'm going to be a huge advocate of maintaining research facilities all across the state. But, you know, I've called northwestern Wisconsin home for most of my adult life. And, you know, our climate, our soils, our growing conditions are unique, just like other areas of the state. So having research facilities that are managed to do in the ground, you know, regional adapted research is how we can maintain relevant data that people who are living in these regions can say, oh, okay, that's research didn't come out of, you know, southern Wisconsin or, heaven forbid, another state or down Texas or something, right? So we need to do research that's in areas of the state where people live and work and have farms and whatnot. So that's a big part of that. As far as our climate and our zone, I think everybody's aware that the USDA came out with a new plant hardiness zone map, and a big part of Wisconsin got transitioned from zone 3 to zone 4. So we are now considered zone 4A. There's little tiny pockets of zone 3 still around. You know, I always tell people, you know, don't jump on the zone 4 bandwagon just yet. Let's slowly adapt and learn what plants do well in zone 4. But one of the things that we are discovering is that, you know, because of climate change, we can grow plants more reliably. And the data and the research that we're collecting from plant materials grown here suggests that. So when I first started here in 1999, I had the pleasure to work with Bob Tomich, and I don't know, Larry, you probably remember Bob, and he would bring plant materials to Spooner, and he'd group them in pairs, obviously, you know, perennial type plants, and he would say, well, take it to Spooner and see if we can kill it, right? See how cold hardy our plants are. So we've been doing that for many years, and as we've gone through the decades, we are now seeing some of our varietals, and I'm thinking more with some of our perennial fruits, i.e. grapes. We've had grapes on the research station since I've been here and even before. These are all cold hardy varieties. And there are now varieties that we used to not recommend that we are now successfully growing here. And the research continues with new varieties as those come on board to look at, all right, what are some of the known varieties of table grapes. Right now we've got a plot of table grapes, and there's varieties that have done well in say Madison, but we never really thought they would work up here. And well, now we have a vineyard with some of those southern varieties here, as well as new developing plant materials from University of Minnesota, I believe, for cold hardiness in the table grape side. So the research stations definitely serve a purpose in helping answer some of those questions about new materials and, you know, which plants are appropriate, and, you know, not just horticulture plants, but, you know, agricultural crops as well.
And as an aside, I'm glad you mentioned Bob Tomich. Bob was a guest on this program many, many times, rest his soul, and always a great guy to have on, and he knew an awful lot. Mary in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Help. I know this is a little off subject, but this is really a big problem. We have land around, we're in town, but have some land, quite a bit of land, really, around the house. But we have woodchucks. And the woodchucks are going underneath the earth, of course, and eating everything they run into, including bulbs and anything else like that. And we've got some tomatoes now. I see somebody's planted that they're after the – and I saw the woodchuck investigating the tomatoes. And I don't know. I have a dim view of the survival of that tomato. So, but I don't know. Do you know anything about woodchucks? And is there?
So you get to experience Groundhog's Day every day, huh? With that sighting. Yes. This gets back to my comment earlier about, you know, gardening with our native, neighbors, i.e. wildlife. And, you know, woodchucks, you know, they're one of our largest rodents. I'm not, you know, the wildlife expert. We have one, Drake. What's his first name?
David Drake,
and he's been on the show before too. But basically, anytime we're dealing with a critter, we have to decide how do we encourage it to take up residency somewhere else, right? So ideally, if we could encourage that groundhog to find other places to live, thus the problem should go away. But how do you do that? You know, you can trap and remove, but now where do you take it? You know, and, you know, most of us would rather do non-lethal management of pests. And, you know, a larger animal like a woodchuck certainly would not be my first choice to go after with any kind of lethal options. But if you can trap it and relocate it, I think that would be a wonderful starting point. But to try to deny it access to your gardens and to your landscape, that could be a real challenge too, because they're great at digging and burrowing and, you know, they're just doing their thing and they're designed to do that. So, you know, there are ways you can trap, and David Drake would have all those options, and you can go online maybe and look on how to trap woodchucks and live trapping, and perhaps, you know, you are successful in that, you can put them on a relocation project someplace else. So that would be my first recommendation. You know, trying to barricade them out is another option, but now you're talking, you know,
a lot of work.
Yeah. And then lethal is not my preferred option at all. So, yeah. You know, trapping and relocation would be the best. It's unfortunate.
Yeah. There you go, Mary. Thanks for calling. Kathy in Trempolo, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry. So my husband and I were introduced or discovered buttercup squash a couple years ago. And so last year we planted it. We had a great success. It was wonderful. It was sweet. This year, I don't know if it was the squash bugs or too much rain, but they didn't survive at all. So we bought one from a farmer's market the other day, and we're so excited to eat it. And it was watery and bland. It had no taste. So my question is, what for winter squash, are there certain conditions that you can, that make a sweeter, fleshier squash?
Well, yes. I mean, there's all kinds of variables that go into producing food and fruit, in this case with the mature winter, you know, squash. But variety selection is always our first choice, right? So you decide you want to grow a winter squash. You got to decide what seed are you going to, you know, purchase or acquire to get there, right? So variety selection is certainly plays a pretty big role in the overall flavor, texture, composition of the fruit, you know, how stringy it is or you know, if it's more watery or more dense. Our storage squashes typically have a little lower water content, so that gives them a different texture and taste, but they'll store longer. So seed selection or variety selection is the first thing. And there are a number of storage squash or winter squash varieties that are very sweet compared to what I maybe used to eat. And now through my experiences, I found varieties that I like because of the way they taste. So that's first thing. And then growing conditions obviously play a role too. When a plant is stressed, they will cause the fruits to maybe get off flavor, and there might be alkaloid compounds and other, phenols and chemistries that the plant creates when it's stressed. And that can now impart some off flavors in our fruit if it's too stressed. So making sure it's, adequately watered, and there's all that fertility stuff. And, this is just general gardening practices for all vegetables is, we got to make sure they're in healthy soil and they have adequate nutrients and water and sunlight. And then beyond that, there are, environmental things that will stress that plant, like I said, and some years we can't do a lot about that, but water would be one. Make sure they're adequately watered, and if you can't do that, that might impact the fruit quality. So,
and if you get too much water, you're going to get, you may get squash that are blander.
Yes. Again, it's, all about moisture management and what, I always tell people who garden, they say, all we're doing is repackaging water into different vessels, right? a watermelon is 95%+ water, right? And it takes water to create these, this food, but it's a balance, right? You don't want to have too much. You don't want to have too little. And then on top of it, too much water, not enough. You get diseases that can impact the leaves and the plants go down prematurely. Diseases on plants cause additional stress. That could impart off flavors in the fruit as well. And every year is different. And just keep that in mind. If this is your only first or second year growing a new vegetable, keep with it. Every year is going to present different challenges, and this might have been one of those seasons where the squash growing conditions on your property was slightly different than the year before, and now you have to learn from that. So I just keep trying and try new varieties every year.
Of the same squash. Kathy, what was the squash you were most interested in? Was butternut?
No, it was a buttercup.
Okay.
Yep. And the buttercup tend to be a little drier than, say, maybe an acorn. If they're a storage variety that are meant to store long, they'll be even a little drier. But the flavors in some of those buttercups that I've, I can't necessarily say a specific variety, but there's all kinds of them out there. And just try. Try some of the older ones. Try some of the brand new F1 hybrids. They're bred specifically for flavor. And one of the things we've done here at the research station is specifically looked at varieties of vegetable that are being bred and selected specifically for flavor. Because as we discover why people don't like vegetables, it might be because they're too bland. And so the genetics play a role in how that works too. So
And so Kathy, that farmer that you bought the squash from might have had a variety that was not one of those varieties that was bred for flavor. You never know unless you ask the variety. If you see that person again, just ask what that variety was and mention to that person that it seemed kind of bland and see what they say. It would be worth it. It was a farmer's market, so that person may still be out there. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You've got that display garden up there, and what are visitors going to see when they stop by the display gardens?
Well, like all gardens, it changes weekly, right? Two-thirds of the garden is annual plants. So in the spring, you're not going to see much yet, but come July and August, when everything's planted with our annuals, you will see a pretty wide display of both vegetables and flowers. But we have a monarch and pollinator garden, which is a perennial space, and that's rocking and rolling right now with all kinds of pollinators and butterflies. I think the monarch migration is starting because our monarchs numbers seem to be up right now, and that might be as they're preparing for that flight south. But we have, we're also an All America Selections display garden. So we feature those plants. We always try to do heirlooms and some of the more traditional, maybe open pollinated varieties. We do a little bit of research in the garden every year through the Seed to Kitchen Collaborative and Seed Linked. So if there's gardeners out there who want to do backyard garden research, the Seed to Kitchen and Seed Link project do just that. You can get small packets of seeds. You got to have a certain amount of space to do it. But we dedicate a bed or two every year to peppers and tomatoes. And then, of course, we've got our row of wine grapes, our row of table grapes, a couple of hop plants on display so people can see just how vigorous those are, a couple of apple trees. But it's really there for display and outreach and teaching. We've got tons of signage. I'm a big fan of teachable moments. And if we can put up a little sign, let people know what they're looking at. I've got a series of Wisconsin pollinator posters or signs that I created that I'm trying to, you know, make sure people know about so they can promote pollinators with these signs. So it's really diverse and it's always changing, of course, because of the time of year. And we had a small killing frost about 2 weeks ago, but for the most part, all the plants are still doing well.
You know, I like those signs because in this day and age with our phones and our cameras on our phones, you can, if you see something you like, you can take a photo of the sign and a photo of the plant or plants, and you got it.
Yeah, we got QR codes on some of those signs too. And, you know, it's all about just getting people excited about gardening and letting them see, you know, stuff. It's a lot of work. It's not something that most people are going to reproduce in their properties, but we do it just like I do at home. No sprays, very little chemical inputs from commercial fertilizers. We try to use organic practices. And to that end, we really took it on the shorts this year with the Japanese beetles on our grapes. But I tell you what, Larry, talk about a trap crop, because that's one of the concepts we talk about when managing pests is like, if you can't beat them, eat them, or let them eat on some plants you don't necessarily care about, so they stay off of your valuable, you know, plants. And they sure love grapes.
So they do indeed. They do.
That was our sacrifice, but I didn't do any green shoot pruning on those grapes this year, because the Beatles did it for me.
Linda in Kenosha, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi. So I have a question. I have a small vegetable garden. It's 10 by 16. I've had it for a few years now. And my question to you is, do you recommend rototilling? I want to put in some more compost and garden soil and kind of beef up the soil a little. Do you recommend rototilling that in, or should I just use like a rake and maybe a shovel or a hoe?
Yeah, and this is where gardening can be really personal and personalized. So, you know, 10 by 16, that's not a massive amount of square footage, but it's still enough area to plant and grow a bunch of food. And I don't know if you are into raised bed gardening or establishing raised beds as a practice in that space, or do you, is it pretty much bare ground and you plant in long, you know, linear rows?
Yeah, it's pretty much bare ground, though I do have a wooden frame around it because I mulched around it for walking and working around the garden. So,
okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure, so so the raised bed concept I really like because you can reach into the beds and don't have to be walking all over, and you don't necessarily have to even do a lot of tillage because you can do it all with a shovel or a broad fork and really reduce the amount of tillage through more aggressive means like with a rototiller. And we haven't used a rototiller, a standard walk-behind rototiller, in our teaching display garden for probably 10 years. We've got a big rototiller we'll use on our bigger beds once in a while, but all of our smaller beds, we're just using hand tools and mixing and turning and adding our amendments that way. So I'm a big fan of adding organic matter. Nothing wrong with, you know, adding compost or mulches or, you know, composted manures. Any organic matter is a good thing to a point. So, you know, you might take a look at that space and say, well, I want to keep doing it the same way I've always done it. But can you do it without doing a lot of unnecessary pulverizing, I call it, with a rototiller? And that's a decision everybody has to come to, because, you know, change is sometimes not as easy to come by with some people. They like the way the soil looks after rototilling. Everything's uniform and you can rake it smooth, but you don't have to. And if you want to try rethinking that with some raised beds and just making, you know, mounds of soil and gardening in those and then have walking paths in between, that's certainly an option too. So, I would say, you know, keep enjoying your garden space. And if you want to, you know, use your rototiller, keep doing it. But there are other ways you might want to try to make it maybe a little more.
I think the rototiller kind of beats up the soil sort of.
Yeah. Yep. And we're changing our tune all the time on this, Larry, right? Because research shows that, you know, when we really aggressively, you know, rototill, we're breaking up some of that structure that supports our soil life. And the mycorrhizal fungi and the other organisms that call the soil home get, you know, they lose that home when we rototill. And then there's a compaction layer that forms eventually if you're doing it year after year after year. You know, so it's just a different way of thinking about it. And try a spot in the garden where you don't do much tillage. And, you know, it's a transition, but we can do it. We don't have to till if we don't want to. But there's times when you got to mix in organic matter with the tiller, and that's fine too.
Kevin Chesso, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Coming up on Monday, you can join us when our weather guys come back to talk climate and weather. And also then Bassam Jakashiri is with us to talk all things science and answer your science questions as well. Right now on Garden Talk, Kevin Chesso, UW Extension Area Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties, our guest. We've been zeroing in on veggies today and soil and water. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Judy in Delavan next. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have a volunteer butternut squash. Grew out of my compost pile. And I'm not sure when it's ripe enough to harvest. Do you wait till the tendril opposite the fruit is dry, or I don't want to harvest it too soon?
You know, we had a farmer call in, Kevin, to talk about the winter squash earlier that we were talking about, and that caller had said, well, that squash was kind of bland, and the farmer called to say winter squash needs 3 nights in a row of 45 degrees or colder temperatures to bring out the sweetness. And she says the squash the caller bought probably didn't get that.
This is a very good point. That's why I love the listeners. They can always remind us of some of these facts that maybe we don't talk about initially, but you are, that person is absolutely correct. You know, winter squash means it, you know, you harvest it in late fall and it goes, you know, stores into the winter. And the environment in how that squash ripens definitely will change the, you know, the flavor and texture of that as we go into fall. So once the plant dies, you know that it's done feeding that fruit. But the weather conditions, as indicated, will sweeten that, you know, the colder temperatures at night. In the warm, you know, and you got to cure it as well so that it stores. So getting back to the caller's question, you know, one of the things that I always look for in a lot of our vine crops, especially watermelon and squash, is, you know, you got the size, you know, and it matures to a certain size. So we have that. And then there's the coloration of the rind. And if it looks like it's the right color for that variety, or what you're assuming it should look like. And then there's this thing we call the ground spot. You know, that's another indication of that fruit becoming more mature or closer to finishing. So you'll see a little halo differentiation of colors between the top of the plant that's exposed to sun and the bottom that's now in the shade. And that ground spot, the more contrast there is to that ground spot to the rest of the squash, indicates that you're approaching full maturity as well. The corkiness of the stem is another indication. Sometimes people on melons will look for the tendrils closest to the stem, and if they're curled up and dry, the thump test, you know, all of those things are good indicators of how far you are. You know, you can always pick one and have that your sacrifice, if you will. And if you think it's really, really close to harvest and you've got a bunch of them, pick one and look at, cut it open and look at the flesh and look at the seed pocket. And if everything looks like it's fully mature, and if it tastes fine, well, then that's a decision on when to harvest. But most of our winter squash should be cured, should go through a killing frost. Again, not 20 degrees, but a light frost shouldn't hurt them. Maybe you cover them up and let them kind of cure out in the field and experience some of those temperature changes that will finish that to a nice ripe, you know, flavor. A volunteer squash coming out of the compost, we don't know what the genetics are behind that, what color it's supposed to be. So we have a little more challenge in figuring out what that wants to be when it's done. But I would let it go right up until we get killing frost and just leave it finished. And that way, you know, for sure.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Judy, so you got a little bit of time to go yet. Thanks for calling. Francis in Barneveld, your turn. Hi, Francis.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I got an asparagus bed that I planted 5-6 years ago. And last winter, something got in it and burned holes. And this spring, we got no root, no asparagus at all. I'm wondering what kind of animal goes in there and burrows down, and do they eat the roots?
Now, is this were these small holes, like a gopher hole, or were these just dug up?
Well, they were kind of like gophers, I thought.
Okay.
Right. Larry, you've heard me say this before in past shows years ago, too, is, you know, now we're after horticulture CSI, right? Crime scene investigation. And some of those leading questions, like Larry started with, help us decide, you know, some of this yes, no, what might be going on? How did this happen? You know, the crime scene is there. We know something happened. Now let's just put on that investigator's cap and say, what evidence, what signs, symptoms, you know, what do we see that will help us look for likely suspects, right? So there should be some eating, chewing, you know, whatever you can see from that damage helps us decide, are we talking a rodent, something with teeth, chompers, something that can, you know, leave some kind of telltale sign that it was a rodent. If it's an insect, that's a little bit different. And if it happened underground and it's a big enough disturbance, my guess is we're talking some kind of mammal, rodent type critter that has the ability to dig and has, you know, teeth that are going to, you know, chew on stuff and cause, you know, problems. And now once that crown is kind of eaten and the buds for that plant are gone, you know, it might outright kill a perennial, you know, root like asparagus. But my guess is if it's an established plant, there should be underground buds that will survive. Maybe this year was a bust and you didn't get much, but I wouldn't quite give up on that and see if you can't let that plant recuperate. But if it's a reoccurring problem, you got to figure out how do you stop that. And, you know, trapping, like we said with the woodchuck, you know, it's always an option to try to, you know, get the mammal away or other means to discourage it from coming back. But I would continue to do some horticulture CSI and see if you can't put the pieces of the puzzle together and figure out what actually caused the damage.
Yeah. And if it was a gopher or something like it, you know, you could use some lethal methods if you wanted, but you still have to be careful because you could, you know, a trap out there could also attract a bird or something too. So there's a lot to think about there, Francis. But I think I'm guessing a small mammal that got in there. But I like Kevin's idea to let it go a year and see if, you know, the plants are going to come back. I think that's a good idea. So give it a try and see what you think. And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kevin, I want to go back to the Seed to Kitchen collaboration, because I think that's worth talking about. And a few minutes before we break for news, can you talk about that?
Sure. Like I said, I've been very fortunate to have this partnership with the research station and the property. And obviously the teaching and display garden is a separate outreach component of what I've done all these years. But this is a research station and we do research for, you know, all kinds of reasons. So the Seed to Kitchen collaborative was started by Julie Dawson a number of years ago. And it's since, you know, there's a bunch of collaborators with different universities and every state kind of figures out how do they want to address local foods. And in this case, Seed to Kitchen incorporates from the seed to the kitchen, meaning there are chefs that got involved right from the get-go, and they use those chefs and their culinary taste buds to help them decide what varieties and what kind of breeding projects they wanted to work on to enhance flavor. So chefs have that intuitive, you know, skill in figuring that out. So when they started this project, they worked with plant breeders and they said, we're going to take a really good, productive, solid variety like, for instance, Wisconsin Lakes pepper, very well-known pepper. Let's cross that with a variety called Dohill, which has this very unique flavor. The chefs just said that would be the match made in heaven if we can get both of those combinations into a new selection. So that's kind of how this whole process starts. They do an initial cross, then they save the seeds and we grow them out in our research plots, replicated. We collect data on them as they mature and as they come to fruition, we, you know, do yields, but then the chefs and other tasters will evaluate which selections get dropped and which ones move forward. So it takes many, many years of this inbreeding, because once we make the original cross, those seeds are then saved and we let them self. They're called selfies from that point on. Open pollen. And the goal is, as time goes on, we cull out those plants that are not appropriate for whatever reason, and flavor being one of them. So we keep selecting out for flavor and production and growth habit. And the next thing you know, we've got a new variety that can be offered to the public. So we're at. And if you Seed the Kitchen, you'll find more information on that. Or SeedLink is the other partner.
And we can talk some more about that. We're going to take a quick look at the news. Kevin Chesso, our guest today, and he'll be with us for another half hour at least. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kevin Shesso, UW Extension Area Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. We've been zeroing in today on especially on vegetables with Kevin, also talking about the Spooner Research Station. But questions, what's going on in your garden? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Kevin, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about the projects that you have going on at the Spooner Experimental Farm. And the uses of the produce, which I think is really interesting. Some of the produce, I mean, it's for teaching people about gardening, but there's other uses as well.
You bet. There's a teachable moment in everything we do, right? And touch, and when we're gardening, I look at that cucumber or that tomato, especially if it's a little unique and different. You know, we certainly have some of that with our plant breeding projects that we get to experience here. And that's where I'm like, as an outreach educator, that's a conversation I can now have with any number of people about all different kinds of things from, you know, what in the world, I've never seen a white cucumber before, right? Or, oh, that's the most beautiful tomato. How, I've never seen one with those kind of stripes and colors and all. And then when they taste it, there's that, you know, experience as well. So you can start with any number of subjects and have those conversations. So one of the benefits of doing research is we have, you know, up to maybe 2 acres of production. And this is not something the average person is going to have access to. I get that. But all of us grow extra plants or extra produce that we now have to decide what to do. And I really just want to remind folks that there are so many organizations, individuals that we can share our produce with. And don't be afraid to reach out to some of those organizations in your local communities to do that. You know, from the pop-up food pantries that show up, the libraries are doing that. Churches have been doing this for a long time. Other organizations that are community-based, you know, will also, you know, provide outlets for some of that stuff. Certainly our food shelves. But where I've really made inroads, partially because of the unique opportunity with our produce, is the schools. So every school district, at least that I've reached out to, has some kind of teacher working on family and consumer science education. The old home ec when I was in school, but cooking classes, my goodness, what a better way to help students learn about local foods than donating a box of our produce. I call it a free SA, right? Not a CSA, but a free SA. It's a box with no numbers. It's, well, weights maybe, but we don't charge for it. It's just use it, enjoy it, let the kids experience some of these unique varieties. They may never see them in a local grocery store, but we can at least let them have that experience. So that's the outreach component of my free SA project. I contact local schools. Hey, would you be willing to, you know, take a delivery of plants? Now we got to get into the whole Uber delivery of these vegetables to the area school districts. But we've got volunteers, and they have, you know, just like the Meals on Wheels, we hook up with volunteers. They deliver them. Sometimes they're the spouse of the teacher or another family member or community member who's helping us get those fruits into the classroom. And then I let the teachers do their magic. But sometimes I go into the classroom and I explain a little bit about where food comes from, right? Mother Earth, sunshine, water, nutrients, and a thing called photosynthesis, right? You know, and it all starts with those kind of conversations, and then it leads to all kinds of interesting questions and curiosities. And now they get to eat things and cook. And you'd be surprised how easy it is to keep somebody's attention when you are talking food. So if there's a way other gardeners can do that, you know, reach out to some of these organizations and offer up some of your stuff. Now, you do have to be aware that they meet certain quality criteria. You know, all of our stuff is grown organically. I explain that. We still say wash before you eat it and all those things. But, you know, there's plenty of food, edible food, that we all have in excess. And it might just be sharing it with your neighbor or other organizations. Like I said, you know, it's just amazing how once word gets out, all of our stuff goes every week. And this time of year, because it's in the prime harvest, we have a high tunnel research, right? 180 tomato plants trellised all the way to the top. And we get 500 pounds of tomatoes out of that every week. Not everybody's going to do that. Obviously, it's subsidized labor with research and all the things we do here. But I'm paying it forward and getting that out into our community so it doesn't go to waste. And we can do that in our own backyards, too.
Well said. Bob in Sun Prairie, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bob. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larry. I got a question, not necessarily for myself, but for my wife. My wife is a very prolific flower gardener. And in the past couple of years, she's had tremendous success. This is up in the Montello area. And basically what she does is she plants her annuals and some perennials and so on and subsidizes them with good old Miracle-Gro. And just last week, she came to me and she said, you know, I heard about this horse farm down the road, and I might be able to get some good old horse manure for fertilizer. And so I just want to hear your thoughts on that. I said, well, if you do that, you might be introducing all kinds of weed seed and things like that. And I said, if you're having success doing it the way you're doing it, then why? So anyway.
Okay. Well, I'm sure Kevin's got some comments on that.
Well, of course, you know, and like you ended your comment, you know, why are you doing it? What's the goal, right? So if you're successful in a gardening practice, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, kind of comment, right? But at the same time, why not, you know, challenge, you know, the way we garden and rethink some of our practices and maybe come up with reasons why we might want to try something different and adapt our gardening practices to include maybe using a more locally sourced fertilizer like your horse manure. But with that said, we certainly are putting ourselves at risk of introducing weed seeds and other changes in our soil and in our practices that we're not used to. And that's why I always say, if you're going to use organic manures or change your gardening practices, start small, keep it simple, right? And maybe do it on a small area and take a bushel basket of this manure and get it on a bed that maybe, you know, you think might benefit from that. And then see how that works compared to your standard practices using the Miracle-Gro. Horse manure is not nearly as concentrated in its nutrients. Obviously, it does have nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, other micronutrients, but at a much smaller concentration than the Miracle-Gro. So you might have to do a little of both, you know, because last thing I want to do is see your wife's success not be there in the future because all of a sudden she switched to this horse manure and everything went south, right? Let's do this very deliberately. Try a small area first and then learn as you go. So the horse manure will definitely increase your chance of bringing in weed seeds. If it's composted and it's a hot compost, we can sometimes reduce that. But invariably, we're going to be bringing in some of those unintended plants through our, you know, so But you've got organic matter. That carbon-based fertilizer is going to improve soil tilth, soil health. It's going to feed the microorganisms. And Miracle-Gro can only do the chemistry. It can only supply nutrients and not necessarily the organic pieces that come with, you know, horse manure.
Yeah.
Both will give you, you know, results you want, but it's, again, what's the end goal?
Stella in Sturgeon Bay actually has some experience to share with horse manure. So let's go to Stella. Hi, Stella.
Hi. When we lived in Missouri, there was a horse farm out just not far outside of town that we learned about. They used sawdust for bedding. They kept their horses in stalls all the time. They had this huge pile, I mean, it was almost as tall as the barn, of very well composted horse manure. And we just took trailer loads of that. We got permission from our landlord to make a garden in the backyard, and we took trailer loads of that. And our garden was just absolutely lush and wonderful. We do organic gardening. The thing with horse manure is horses are seeders. Seeds go through their gut unscathed, and they come out fertilized in the poop. So you need to make sure that it's well composted before you use it in your garden. But once it is well composted, it is absolutely wonderful.
Very good points, Stella. Thank you so much for calling. And really, on that earlier caller with the horse manure, that manure should be, if you compost it, Kevin, you're going to have a lot less, fewer problems. Let's put it that way.
Well, of course. And I always say, you know, understand the source and, of course, the pros and cons. And there's both, right? And Stella mentioned that with the fact that composting kind of breaks down some of those organic compounds that might tie up nutrients, like that sawdust she mentioned. No, the weed seeds, you really got to have a hot compost to eliminate those. But eventually, you know, some of those weeds might die out on their own if it's left long enough, like she indicated. And if you know the source of where you're, you know, if you go there and physically see the pile of manure, like she, you know, suggested, you feel a little more confident in what you're bringing home. And the older it is, the more composted it is, obviously, the better. And just know that there's always going to be that risk of bringing in unwanted, hitchhikers in mostly in the seeds, and just be prepared for that. But the long range benefits of adding organic matter to any soil is always going to be better than not. And I've told this before to you, Larry, and others, people, the three things I always suggest to do to improve most soil is, number one, add organic matter. Number two, try some more organic matter. And maybe number three, keep putting organic matter down. You know, there's so many good things. If you do it right, if you know the source, you can overdo it. Too rich a compost or too rich a manure, like poultry litter and poultry, you can get hot, you know, burn your plants with too much urea, you know, too much nitrogen. But in general, at least on a new garden bed, you know, adding organic matter is always going to be helpful to a certain point.
Yeah. Well, Mary in New London emailed, she has some small garden beds up against her house that haven't been touched for 20 years. She's in the process of removing the current plants, mostly irises, to make room for more natives. But the soil is so very hard. Any tricks for breaking it up? She's tried shovels, forks, hand trowels. It's really difficult to try to mix compost with the soil she has already broken up.
Yeah. So this is like remediation from a, you know, I don't say construction site. When we've got an abused soil, perhaps, is that's one way to look at it, where you now have physical and probably biological conditions that are not ideal. And, you know, physically, we need porosity. We need water retention, you know, and when it's compact and hard, we're not giving that soil the adequate, you know, structure it needs for roots to grow and help, you know, plants to be healthy. So, you know, physically, you're looking at just trying to do as much as you can to bust some of that soil, up. And again, if you really can't get it to a state you like, there's always the option of removing some of it and replacing it with something else, if it comes to that. But the addition of organic material over time should help plant roots to become established in that bed, and those plant roots might help break up some of that compaction. You've got water infiltration and some dissolving of minerals and just other physical chemical reactions that might soften that soil up over time. But it's going to take a while for that to mellow out, but increasing the organic matter and getting plant roots into that spot are one way to, you know, remediate it, short of, you know, excavating out and getting rid of the worst of the compaction and replacing it with something else. So, you know, not always simple to correct, you know, situations, but over time, you should be able to get that soil, you know, health to improve. And that's mostly with, like I said, the organic matter additions and plant roots and biology, soil life, working on that soil to bring it back. But it's not going to be overnight.
Community gardener in Eau Claire emailed, the last 2 years they've had their Brussels sprout plants grow very tall and leafy. However, the Brussels sprouts themselves do not grow large or dense. They opened up very early, have no viable Brussels sprouts. Last year was dry, this year was wet, though they did try and water well last year. Question, they use a heavy leaf mulch layer each fall, and their soil tends to be excellent. Besides too much nitrogen, is there anything else they should know about growing Brussels sprouts?
Ooh, yeah, I've always thought of Brussels sprouts as one of those specialty crops. It definitely is a long season crop, and you got to keep that in mind when you're selecting varieties. I'll get back to never hurts to try new varieties as another way to see if that might give you a little bit more success. But if you've got a tried true variety that always worked and all of a sudden it's not, well, then there's something else going on in the environment that might be causing the plant to not be as productive as it once was. So it's a cool season vegetable. You know, temperature might be some of the reason why those florets or little sprouts aren't forming like they should. Inadequate or uneven moisture might be causing some of that stress. If you've got otherwise healthy soil and you're not over fertilizing, that shouldn't be a factor to consider. Like I said, I'm not a big Brussels sprouts grower myself, and I like them. I like to grow them, but I don't know enough about the nuances that make one year different than the other, and how do you manage them so that the florets are there, if that's, you know, the issue. I don't know if there's insects that might be messing with them, or a little bit of disease that could cause the poor crop. You have to do a little bit more investigating on, you know, what is preventing that, because, you know, you have various diseases that could cause some of that. But I guess I'm just not as an experienced a Brussels sprout grower to know some of those tricks, right? I mean, you know, same with cauliflower. I mean, I hardly ever grow that for the same kind of reasons, because you got to know how to, you know, blanch the heads or keep them covered. And, you know, there's little tricks to some of these crops, and Brussels sprouts might just be one of those that's for, the more experienced. Keep asking around, talk to other experienced Brussels sprout growers. You know, somebody at a farmer's market that seems to be, you know, successful in bringing that to market, or, you know, other, you know, folks you might know. You can always go online and search, you know, Brussels sprout growing and management, UW Extension or .edu, and get some good university fact sheets on Brussels sprouts, and maybe there's something there you learn too.
Yeah, absolutely. Pam wonders, she wants to winterize her patio garden, largely pots, one raised rectangular bed. In the last minute or so, any advice there on winterizing?
Well, if you're going to be saving that soil and you don't want to dump it out, you know, and if they're not perennial plants in those pots, you know, you don't have to do much at all. I, like I said, have lots of pots. Once I remove the plant material, I just move them and stack them up and put them on the north side of my house by, you know, in a spot that's out of the way for the winter. And then come spring, I dump the soil out and start over. So if you've got plants in those pots that you want to overwinter, that's when we got to be really aware of the temperature that soil gets to over the winter, and providing some kind of insulation so those soil temperatures don't get, you know, into the low 20s, and then you're going to kill off roots because it, you know, just got too cold. But I don't think there's anything too extravagant as far as preparing those pots for winter if they're annuals, but perennials, definitely got to heal them in, bury them in the ground, provide a whole bunch of extra insulation, move them into a garage area that's still cold, but maybe doesn't get quite as cold. So that's, you know, I don't know if it explains the situation that she's in, but that's how I would look at containers.
Well, Kevin, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to another visit from you. Thank you, Kevin.
Well, always a pleasure, and if you're ever up this way, Larry, or anybody else, you know, Highway 53 goes right past, not that far from the Teaching and Display Garden, if folks want to check it out.
All right. Kevin Chesso, UW Extension Area Ag Development Educator for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Coming up, we're going to take a look at agroforestry. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to turn our attention to agroforestry. You may or may not be familiar with agroforestry, but our next guests certainly are, and they're happy to tell you about it. Back with us from the Savannah Institute, our Jacob Grace, Communications Project Manager. Welcome back, Jacob.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And with us as well, Adam D'Angelo, the Breeding Operations Manager for the Institute. Adam, great to have you back as well.
Great to be back, Larry.
As we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. They'll talk about perennial farming and tell us about the upcoming perennial farm gathering coming up in October. Questions, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about agroforestry? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Jacob, first, maybe you can talk about the mission of the Savannah Institute.
Sure. So the Savannah Institute is a nonprofit organization. We're about 10 years old, and our mission is we want to see more perennial agriculture in the Midwest. So that's anything perennial plants that keep roots in the ground all year long. And our main focus as an organization, as you mentioned, is on agroforestry. So that's any ways that we can use trees on farms, use trees for agricultural purposes. And there are a lot of different ways that can look, a lot of different examples, but That's what our organization exists to do, is to help spread the word about agroforestry and to help people do it well.
And there, this is growing. I mean, what is it? Did you say 9 years? Or
is, or about 11 years 11 old.
11 years
as an
old
organization.
Now,
yep.
And there are a number of states included in this.
Yeah, so most of the work we're doing, I would say, is kind of southern Wisconsin and north central Illinois, but the plants that we work with, that Adam works with, are, you know, grow all across the upper Midwest. And so this work is really relevant for people in Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, and even farther east.
Yeah. And the name, where's the name come from?
Well, our work is kind of inspired by the savanna ecosystems, which is what used to cover, you know, most of the area that we live and work. So these are highly productive ecosystems that were, you know, had a lot of different plants growing, supported a lot of different species, but they had trees growing in them too. And that's something that's, that we want to kind of return our farming systems to look a little bit more like the savannas that used to be here.
Alice in Middleton has a question for you guys. Let's go there. Alice, hi.
Hi there. It's not quite related to savannas, but I'm curious about growing hazel nuts in Minnesota. I've seen them in Oregon as big plantations, and curious about having a few trees or giant shrubs in my yard.
Yeah. Adam, you want to take a crack at that?
All right, I could take a crack at it. So the hazelnuts you see growing in Oregon are actually European hazelnuts, and that was it's a very domesticated crop. It came from Europe, and when settlers first came to the Americas, they would plant these trees and they'd find out that they died. And they would always die from a disease called Eastern Filbert Blight. So they kept planting them, they kept dying, and they kept trying it in different places. And eventually they found out they could grow them in Oregon, where the disease had not yet been introduced or hadn't evolved. Now, that Eastern Filbert Blight, that was living on a native species of hazelnut called the American hazelnut, which grows all throughout the Midwest. It's plenty up in Minnesota and Wisconsin, all over. But those nuts aren't quite the quality that we typically eat. So when you see the Oregon hazelnut industry growing European hazelnuts, that's mostly because they don't have the disease over there. Now, if we're trying to grow them in the Midwest, we can't get that European material to survive. It's also a little bit cold for that material. But what we have been able to do is hybridize between the European hazelnuts and American hazelnuts, so we get the disease resistance and cold hardiness and vigor and survivability of the American hazelnut, but we start to reintroduce the nut quality and the great flavor of the European hazelnut. And that's a lot of the work we do at Savannah, is crossbreeding between those. And we're part of the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative, which is a multi-state program working on these hybrid hazelnuts to provide new crops for small farmers to grow high-yielding, great-tasting hazelnuts. So stay tuned. Good stuff to come.
Well, yeah. Well, if Alice wanted to grow one of those tomorrow, could she do it or start?
You should check out the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative website, UMHDI, and you can also find links to that through our website, savannainstitute.org, and we can direct you right there. And you can find out how to get those plants and what the timeline is for the next new varieties coming out.
Alice, there you go. Thanks so much for that question. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Well, Adam mentioned one of the kind of programs. Jacob, what are some of the other programs that the Institute offers?
Yeah, so we're a nonprofit organization. So what we do is research, demonstration, and education. And that involves a lot of different things, but one of the big things we have coming up, which I don't want to forget to mention, is our big event of the year is coming up. Actually, a couple big events are coming up next weekend. So we're going to be having an open house at our demonstration farm near Spring Green, Wisconsin on Saturday, October 5th. That's free and open to the public. It'll be family friendly. We'll have farm tours. We're also going to have live music and perennial food tastings. And then October 6th through 8th here in Madison at Monona Terrace, we're going to be having our perennial farm gathering. And this is kind of our biggest event of the year, bringing together people who are interested in agroforestry, interested in perennial agriculture, people who might be farmers, but also people anywhere in that supply chain. So our keynote speaker this year is Chef Sean Sherman from Minnesota. So we're thinking about not just growing these plants and taking care of them, but also how they can end up on our plates and on our tables.
Sean's been on the program in the past.
That's what I heard.
So tell us a little more about what he's going to be doing.
So Sean Sherman is involved in a lot of different things, which I won't list off, but is doing a lot of work thinking about indigenous foods and how to use some of these perennial crops, which have in many cases a rich indigenous history, and kind of bringing that to the forefront in the things that we grow here in the U.S. And then also not just the growing side, as I mentioned, but kind of on the food and flavor side as well, and thinking about making those connections. And then we're going to have a lot of other speakers from Wisconsin and beyond talking about different ways to make that happen.
Very interesting. Adam, what are the different crops that are grown at the Institute?
Sure. Well, that's a big question. I'll focus on the ones that we have active research and plant breeding programs are.
Okay.
So we work with chestnuts, hazelnuts, persimmons, black currants, and elderberries as our main focused breeding crops. And when I say plant breeding, that means we're selecting new varieties. We're trying to make new named varieties that taste great, grow well, and have better flavor, better nutritional content, better yields for farmers. So it's all traditional plant breeding. We're making cross-pollinations between parents and growing out lots and lots of seedlings and looking through them and finding the best ones.
And what's the success been so far?
So we're real early in this, and plant breeding is a long game, that's for sure.
Especially with tree crops, as we talk about a lot.
Yeah, but if you have us back in 15 to 20 years, but all jokes aside, we actually have been making some wonderful progress, and we've seen a lot of this has always been standing on the shoulders of giants. So if you start with the best material there is and try to make even better material. So we've already got the hazelnuts have been being worked on for 20 plus years from the Upper Midwest Hazelnut Development Initiative, and this is sort of the next generation of them. And then a lot of our work is also developing new tools to make this whole process more efficient. So the tools that can help our breeding programs, but also catalyze this and help other breeding programs around the country to make better varieties adapted for their climates as well.
How can any of these ideas work in a home garden?
In a home garden? Well, I think they're really applicable there, too, because particularly in your backyard, that is really valuable real estate, right? If you only got room for one fruit tree, you want to make sure that it's going to make great fruit, great quality. So we've also been trialing a lot of the already available varieties out there to see which performs best and to help make informed recommendations for management of those trees. So once again, you can check out savannainstitute.org, and that's Savannah, S-A-V-A-N-N-A, like yep. The ecotype, not the city in Georgia. And you can find lots of our research and growing guides on there.
I want to jump on that question, too, if it's okay, Larry.
Yeah.
Just thinking about what people can do in their backyards. You know, we talk about tree crops, but we also grow things like elderberries and black currants. So some of these berry crops, which you don't need that much space to grow. Some things like elderberries can grow really vigorously, and black currants can do well in poor soils and do well in shady conditions. And that's another thing to keep in mind for yards, is that part of agroforestry is thinking about plants that can grow in shade or more forest ecosystems. So for people that do have a shadier backyard where it's hard to grow some of their more common vegetables or things you might expect, you might look into, there are different names for it, but forest farming or forest gardening. There are other options that people can look into there.
And we do get a lot of questions. what can I grow in the shady spots?
Exactly. Yep.
So there you go. Our guests from the Savannah Institute, Jacob Grace, Communications Project Manager, and Adam D'Angelo, the Breeding Operations Manager. Questions for them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look today on Garden Talk at the Savannah Institute with our two guests, Jacob Grace and Adam D'Angelo. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today at 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from Dave in Oshkosh next. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if there's been any investigation of what plants can grow under black walnut trees.
And, you know, you do work with black walnuts, for sure.
Yeah, we're doing a little work with black walnuts. Adam, do you want to take that question?
Yeah, so...
Adam's our plant management and our plant expert over here.
So I'm going to give you a bit of a vocab word. That's what you can take away from the show today. It's called allelopathy, and that's the... what's happening with the black walnut trees, which are secreting a chemical through their roots or maybe through the holes of the nuts that are falling in the leaves, that is making it hard for species to grow under them. Now, there's still a lot of research to be done on the actual mechanism of a lot of this, but we are certainly looking at which crops can be grown, and that's a multi-year effort, and it depends on a lot of conditions. But stay tuned.
Yeah, so there's... I guess there are some plants that will grow under a black walnut, but...
Yeah, maybe something I'll add to that is we haven't really talked much about livestock yet, and livestock can be a part of agroforestry too, and so some of these trees that it might be harder to grow crops under, you can think about growing some type of productive pasture underneath and think about trees that might work well in combination with something small like chickens or something big like cattle, and agroforestry can be part of that too.
Yeah, makes sense. Dave, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll take another call in just a second. I want to go back to the demonstration farms. Well, the purpose of a demonstration farm is probably to demonstrate something, but talk about them, and maybe you could even zero in on the Spring Green demonstration farm where your event's going to be.
Yeah, that sounds great. So as we've been talking about, part of our work at the Savannah Institute is showing people what agroforestry can look like. And it can take a lot of different forms depending on what your land looks like, what your weather is like, and what your goals are. And so that we're really trying to have a number of different demonstration farms to kind of give people an idea of what's possible. So we have several different demonstration farms in Illinois. And then here in Wisconsin, we have a few different farms around the town of Spring Green, which we're calling our Spring Green campus. And this is where we're going to be hosting our open house on Saturday, October 5th, which, as I mentioned earlier, that's free and open to the public. We hope you'll consider joining us for that. And it's a chance to see an agroforestry farm where we're trying a lot of different things. And part of our role as a nonprofit organization is that not only can we kind of show people what's possible and show what agroforestry can look like, but our organization can also kind of take some risks and lead the way on some things that maybe it's not a good idea for an individual farmer to be taking a risk with some of these things, things that individuals might not really be set up to do some of these things. As a nonprofit, that's our role, is to kind of take some of these risks and also have the research and the power to kind of back it up and learn from our mistakes and pass those lessons on to other people.
Yeah, makes sense. Barbara in Madison has a comment for us. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I wonder if you could address the joys and hazards of having fruit trees in your yard, such as what it might attract that might invade your house.
Ooh, invading the house.
Sounds what like have he's... you got invading your house, Barb?
Red squirrels.
Oh, no.
Well, I'd suggest reframing the red squirrel guests to be a joy. Rather. So the obvious joy is that you have access to fresh fruit and nuts to share with your neighbors and your family. And some of the steps you can take to prevent attracting rodents is if you are really good about picking the fruit as it ripens or not letting it sit on the ground, that can help reduce pest pressure in the backyard. And also just the selection of fruits that you're planting.
Yeah, I think the pickup, that's the thing. If you've got a nut tree, which several of my neighbors have,
yeah,
which the squirrels bring over to my place.
Yeah. Well, there's some technology to help with that too. I know there are some handheld tools that people mm-hmm. use that can help harvest those nuts really quickly. Mm-hmm. And then this is less feasible in a yard, but I think that's another case for getting livestock involved with some of these mm-hmm. fruit trees, is if the fruit fall on the ground and they're not good for human consumption anymore, at some point you can run some livestock through there and help you clean up some of that fallen fruit.
Yeah, and in the meantime, Barbara, you need to tighten up your house.
Right.
Think of them as community members. I interviewed an author who had wrote a book about thinking of the animals and birds that are in your neighborhood as community members. And had a really interesting book, frankly, about how they work together in a community, and how to if you look at them in a different way, I think it helps. It helps.
Yeah.
Saeed in Green Bay, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Saeed? Hello.
Hi, Saeed. What's on your mind?
Well, this isn't Saeed, but what's on my mind is the guy that called about the walnuts and what grows under them. I can give a couple recommendations.
This is Keith. I'm sorry.
Hundreds of, not Keith either, but okay. Hundreds of walnut trees and gooseberries and raspberries absolutely for sure grow well under walnuts. And I believe blackberries do too.
Ah. Well, there you go. So, I think you'd probably agree with that, Adam?
Yeah, and I'd probably throw in black currants there as well.
So, black currants. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Now I'm not sure who's...
Yeah.
All right. Keith, thank you very much for calling. And you have a water quality question?
Yeah, actually, I have a couple questions, but first, we live in an 1880s log cabin, and steel siding works good to keep the red squirrels out. So I'm up in Kewaunee County. We've got a lot of, 90% forest originally, and now it's 80% ag land. We have a lot of water quality issues. Just wondering if you folks know of any incentive kind of programs to help farmers transition to agroforestry, savannah type things. And second, I've been growing butternuts for my butternut trees make it about 25 years or so, and they get these cankers on them, and just wondering if there's any butternut out there that is not susceptible to that.
Couple of things go on there.
Yeah, maybe I can take the water quality question and hand off the other one to Adam to see what he has to say. But yes, there is funding available for folks that want to do agroforestry. And that's part of the work that we do at the Savannah Institute, is trying to increase the support for these practices. And also, one of the services that we offer is that we have a technical assistance program. So you can contact the Savannah Institute and be connected with someone on our staff who can work one-on-one with landowners and farmers to help them plan and implement an agroforestry practice. So that's something we're really trying to do to help get more agroforestry out on the landscape, and to get agroforestry that works, and to learn from mistakes that that other people have made for us, and make the most of those. So there is funding through NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service. There are a few different cost share programs, and there's a relatively new program, the Expanding Agroforestry Program, which is kind of funneled through the Nature Conservancy, but is a program funded with the USDA and a lot of partners. And in our region of Wisconsin and the surrounding states, the Savannah Institute is kind of the point of contact for that program. And so there is funding available for people who have a plan for their agroforestry planting and can prove that they kind of know what they're doing. There's funding available mm-hmm. for that.
And your site again, I mean, we're going to have that up on as a link on our page today.
Okay.
WPR.org/Larry, but just go ahead and give that again, how people can contact you.
Thank you. Yeah, that's SavannahInstitute.org, as Adam said. That's SAVANNA with no H. And you can find all this information there. Also information about our upcoming events next weekend, the open house on Saturday, and then the perennial farm gathering at Monona Terrace.
Yeah, and Adam, what about the other part of that, the butternuts?
Well, I'm going to expand on what Jacob said first, is that I think one of the strongest things about Savannah Institute is sort of the holistic approach we've been taking to this. So not only do we have these research programs like I've been talking about, but we have these demonstration farms to help produce some of these crops so that farmers and even people who use the crops can get acquainted with them. But we also have these technical service providers. We have people doing research on just the best way to grow, harvest, and store the fruit. We have economists working to develop markets. And we're really trying to engage every aspect of this to develop a more robust supply chain. And along with that, we also have ecologists working to monitor the impact that these crops can have on water quality and soil health and biodiversity of species within the land. And there's so much going on. It's really exciting.
Yeah.
As far as the butternuts, how sad it was to see the butternut canker come and rip through the countryside. Unfortunately, there isn't really a good source of resistance yet, but there are some interesting hybrids. So the Japanese heartnut, which is like a Japanese walnut, that will grow here well. But there's also a number of hybrids between them that have occurred just naturally from people planting heartnuts on the landscape. And they're called boartnuts, butternut heartnut hybrids.
And
they,
oh, no.
They are they're very similar functionally to butternuts, and they grow in the same environment, and they make a great tasting nut.
Amazing.
Yep.
I didn't know that. Can you actually get those? I mean, are they available from growers? Or?
Yeah, you can grow heartnuts, you can grow boartnuts. You know, also if you have, so they're very closely related to black walnuts. So if you have black walnuts in your yard, you can even grow things like your regular English Carpathian walnut. You can graft that onto black walnut rootstock. So there's lots of options in the juggling clade of species there.
And we're short on time here, but there's an apprentice program.
Yes,
I wanted you mention that apprentice program, because
yeah,
I think that's key.
Yeah, especially with these working with tree crops, long-lived crops, it's really important to think about future generations, and that's a big part of agroforestry, is kind of thinking more long-term with the farming that we're doing and with the agriculture that we're doing. So we have an apprenticeship program that pairs interested individuals with different farms that have been doing agroforestry for a long time, that have the knowledge, that have the experience. Mm-hmm. So this is an opportunity for these folks to learn hands-on on these farms. And we're doing a lot of work with the apprenticeship program, including trying to make it more available for people who want to work a full-time or most of the time job at the same time, so they don't have to drop everything to do this apprenticeship. We have options where they can do it kind of evenings and weekends for people who want to get that experience.
That's just great. And the events coming up on Friday and Saturday of, Saturday and Sunday of next week.
Correct. Yep.
Are key. And you can get that, all the information on participating in those at the Savannah Institute website. So
that's correct.
Sped along here, Jacob and Adam. Thank you both so much for being with us today. Jacob Grace, a communications project manager. Adam D'Angelo, the breeding operations manager for the Savannah Institute. And other people involved here in the show, my goodness, it's a team effort always. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our technical directors, and our Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our technical directors. Our producers were Clara and Joel, and our executive producer, of course, is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on WPR News.